Schweizer Amerika. Views from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler. Grüezi miteinander and welcome to another episode of Views from the Sister Republic. Roe v. Wade, Dobbs, Marbury v. Madison, we all have memorized some of the Supreme Court's hallmark cases, the landmark cases that have changed the way America works, America's governed, and American society functions. Maybe learning resources versus Trump will not be that big of a landmark case, but maybe it will be. Here to break down this question with me is the guest of the very first Grüezi Amerika podcast episode, Christoph Frey. Christoph, you don't really need an introduction anymore. It's wonderful that you're joining me at such short notice.
Thank you very much, Claudia, for having me.
What was your first reaction when you heard that the Supreme Court struck down Donald Trump's signature policy, his much coveted tariff regime?
Perhaps a wee bit of Schadenfreude. But then again, you know, it's a wee bit of Schadenfreude. And at the same time, even with all the distance, or perhaps thanks to all the distance that we have on this side of the big water, it was quite clear from the very beginning a few days ago that this may not have been the last, let's say, the last word in what is going on, even on the side of tariffs themselves. And so I have come to learn over the last, 48 or 72 hours, that yes, it is indeed going to be at least as complicated as it was before.
I mean, just as Kavanaugh said in his dissent that this is going to be a mess, he said that mainly with the possibility of refunding importers for the tariff levies that they have paid, but this is in general a big mess. Or let's say this hasn't really made the situation for anyone more secure and easier to calculate by any means. What do you make of the majority that we saw deciding this case?
Relief, I guess. Honestly, and in a very straightforward kind of opening up to you, Claudia, relief. Because yes, we have had other instances where the Supreme Court would actually support Trump's agenda. If I'm still kind of living with the presidential immunity case about, 2 years ago, not quite 2 years ago, to the presumption of immunity and thereby impunity on the side of presidents acting as presidents. So this time around, the Supreme Court went in the other direction. The majority said, no, you can't do that. It's not your thing. You're abusing your slack or your leeway. And no, this time it's not okay. So relief in that the judicial branch would actually stand up and check the executive branch. So that's what, you know, checks and balances are all about. And so again, in that regard, I'm quite happy. But, you know, and then and then there are all the things that we have seen ever since and over these couple of days. And it's going to be very interesting, even on the, let's say, policy side, how this is going to evolve, because he's certainly not going to back down. He will try to pursue. And so it's one more interesting moment.
Yeah, I agree that there was a sense of relief looking at this bipartisan coalition of justices voting against Trump, essentially, or joining the majority and telling him, no, this is as far as your presidential power goes. And seeing that actually his own nominees, Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, sided with the Chief Justice, John Roberts, together with the three remaining liberal justices, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, that were really showing a rare sight of bipartisan resistance to the president. I was, however, taken aback by the reasoning. I'm not a lawyer, nor are you a legal scholar. So we're of course looking at this as legal layperson. But I was still struck by the reasoning of the dissenters, particularly Clarence Thomas, an originalist, a constitutionalist in the what I used to think purest sense, who suddenly sees presidential power reaching further beyond what the founders saw, and Brett Kavanaugh quipping pretty much that there would be a, quote, mess, as if a mess should be preventing law from being enacted. I was also semi-relieved by the president's reaction, because he did not for a second question that, of course, this is now the law and there is no going against the law. And it was really in this regard, he was true to his word when in interviews in the past, he said that, of course, he couldn't go against a Supreme Court decision. Comma, however, he was as bad and actually worse than some of his predecessors in how he then spoke of those who went against him in the conservative realm. So
very disappointing. Very disappointing.
Well, we wouldn't expect better, of course. Yeah. And actually, we have seen politicians of whom we expected better being just as bad. I'm reminded of when a few Democrats in Congress voted against increasing security for Supreme Court justices because they wanted to send a message after Dobbs. So there has been really playing with justices' lives, because there have been threats, there have been attacks on the lives of Supreme Court justices. So we're not surprised, but we would have liked to see better. And I'm really curious to see how he acts when he gives his State of the Union address, how much he will dwell on the tariff decision. So I'm not going to make any prognosis.
It's you know, at least as a kind of an intermediate kind of result here, we both agree that, yes, to some extent, we have reason to be relieved. And that is not nothing. You know, again, relief is relief here. Mm. Because you just, with him, you just never quite know. And as you say, the fact that he actually goes, you know, comes there in the press conference, or into the press conference, and yes, he does acknowledge without even trying to, you know, go in a different direction. So that is wonderful. And at the same time, and this is the, like, twist, the ironic twist here, that, you know, the Supreme Court allegedly does the right thing, you know, what many of us would expect for the court to do. And yet it doesn't really simplify things. It kind of increases complexity, because yes, they're doing their job. They're standing up. They're going against presidential executive power. And yes, it's making things more complicated. Because, you know, more judiciary or judicial bickering and judicial, you know, procedures will come from this. So isn't it, you know, or how far have we come to realize at this point that the Supreme Court does the right thing, and at the same time, things get much more complex yet again, because we don't quite know what's going to come of it. Not least the mess that you mentioned with Brett Kavanaugh, you know, the these payback procedures, who is going to get what and what kind of delay, how much energy, time and energy and resources will go into this process?
Absolutely. And I think it's quite typical of the Supreme Court that has a tendency to say yes, but or no, but and leave some parts up in the air because it knows, it has always known that it cannot enforce its own decisions and therefore has to, that these decisions are, yes, legal, but the entire history and historians of the Supreme Court have shown that these are also political decisions. And not going into detail on the refund question or not touching that at all is one way in which the Supreme Court says no, but. And the other thing is that it has also outlined that there are other avenues for the president to pursue. And these other avenues have always been open to the president. And some in his administration have said that he should have chosen them in the first place, although they are more, well, work intense, shall we say, and require collaborating with Congress. They require lengthy investigations into so-called unfair trade practices, but it would have put the whole thing on a more secure footing had it then led to the same regime. Now, we're looking at this from the outside, as trade partners of the US who have embarked on a journey, on a painful, contentious, etc., journey to have a trade agreement. Where do you see us headed here?
You mean Switzerland, Claudia?
Oh, yes. Oh, is there another us, Christoph? Of course, our non-Swiss listeners hear a different us, but yeah. But we're looking at each other as compatriots.
I wish I knew, but for once, I mean, Helene Budliger at our, one of our top shots at the sick going burn, you know, she said on Saturday or Sunday that, you know, for the time being, we will be well advised to stand by, wait, see, and with some humility, just wait and see, you know, till the dust has settled somewhat. And then let's say, make decisions. But I think you said it, and a few others have said it, Stefan, our colleague Stefan Lege. You know, what kind of options do we have rather than continue and try to get to a modicum or minimum of, safe or expectations that you can basically build your expectations or put your expectations on something. And ideally, of course, that will still be an agreement at some point. But yes, until we get there, let's just see how things evolve. But no, I would not, recommend the Swiss government to basically change their attitude or to venture themselves into something that would only add to all the uncertainty. So basically, stay put, wait what's going to, how things are going to evolve, and then proceed.
I was struck by some of the political commentary by some of our members of parliament, etc., who were hoping that we would now go to war on this against Trump and to show resistance, etc. And I felt that many were desperately looking for a way to get back at the president, because there had been this feeling of defenselessness, helplessness, and now finally he was told off, and shouldn't we be able to get something out of this? Shouldn't we be able to get back at him, have our revenge? But I personally believe that would be foolish and would put us at risk.
So, you're in good company.
I mean,
it would be foolish. It would also perhaps be a tad childish, because who are we to resist the American administration? You know, if you speak or want to speak of a common market, the EU 27 or that kind of coalition or whatever, but you know, to stand up and resist the American administration in a field where your market with 9 million consumers is pitted against a market with 345 million consumers. Come on. So that's why I dare use an attribute such as childish. It would not only be imprudent, it would just be another instance of Überschätzung, a complete and utter misjudgment in terms of who we are. I know this is not heroic, but I guess it's realistic.
Well, some type of heroism is indeed just foolhardy. So we'd rather be cowardly pragmatic. I mean, one thing is our perspective. The other thing is the perspective of Republicans who have to face the voters' music in November. What is your take on some of the dissent that we have already heard in among Republicans who are seeing the tariff regime more and more critically, particularly vis-a-vis the northern neighbor, Canada? Do you think that the president might see his whole policy crumble, or do you think that's just wishful thinking of those who learned in trade economics that tariffs are no good?
Let me start with the Republicans. You mentioned those who already started to moderately resist or voice discomfort over Trump's whole trade policies and trade schemes. Claudia, if there is one prediction that is, as far as I'm concerned, that is easy to make today, the Republicans are going to squirm over what happened here. And then the Democrats are going to enjoy a great deal what happened here. My hunch is that, you know, this is mid-February, going into the summer. Oh, my goodness. You know, if I had to give you an estimate, I would say like a considerable share of the resources that are going into the midterms in terms of the campaigns, a considerable share of resources will be about affordability in connection with these tariffs. Because I'm not quite sure where, in terms of the polls, where Americans stand today. But my hunch, Claudia, is that at least half, if not more than half of Americans are at least not happy with the trade policies. And take the affordability issues, it's the economy stupid. Take the fact that many, many economists, I happened to be with David Dorn this morning, David Dorn at Zurich University, the David Dorn who, together with David Arthur, authored the book on the China syndrome and what happened in the United States and the tariffs that, you know, that the Trump, the first Trump administration would impose, Claudia. And more, or let's say just there is robust evidence that the Americans are paying for these tariffs. There has been a new study released in February a few weeks ago. So what I'm trying to say is Democrats are going to enjoy this a lot. And I think for Republicans, it's not going to be easy to defend this whole policy, all the more now with the Supreme Court, right? Because the Supreme Court, as I see it, still enjoys some modicum of credibility, at least as much credibility as the House of Representatives and the Congress. So to come back to your question, for Republicans, this is going to be difficult. And the Democrats will enjoy this. And it's going to it's going to be, well, interesting to see how this is going to evolve, but also, Claudia, to what extent Trump might react going into the summer, going into the fall, Claudia. Will this president stick to the 15%? Will this president, and beyond July, right? I mean, the 15%, this is going to be in Congress in by July, 150 days, section 122. So this is going, this should be interesting. Once again, you're not going to run out of work, Claudia, explaining
Neither
what's going on.
Neither will anyone else who is a modicum interested in the U.S. I just want to back up what you said in terms of approval and disapproval of Trump's tariff policy. So the Pew Research Center, which is a nonpartisan think tank that does a lot of polls on all sorts of issues, American related, has in early February released a poll according to which two-thirds of Americans disapprove of the Trump policy. And so that was prior to the Supreme Court decision. However, a problem is that while over 90% of Democrats disapprove or strongly disapprove of the tariff policy, still 71% of Republicans or voters leaning Republican approve of the tariffs. So it will still need work by the Democrats trying to win over Republicans leaning or voters leaning Republican or independents as well onto their side in more contested voting districts. But I think you're right on that this is going to be one of the winning narratives of the Democrats. If they link affordability to tariffs, and if they also lean on the research that has shown, David Dorns is one of them, that actually the tariff policy the first time around already didn't create any jobs or hardly any jobs. Why should it be any different this time around? And you consumers are already paying the price. So if the Democrats play smart and stick to it's the economy, stupid, this is going to be the blue wave that they have been waiting and hoping for.
I at least that's like a gut feeling or an intuition. I have no evidence here, but it's very plausible that this is going to really become a major bone of contention going into the summer and going into the fall, into the campaign or campaigns in the plural. And then, you know, you mentioned the narratives, Claudia. And then on the other side, there is that moment that so many economists are waiting for when inflation, I mean, we all know that imports, you know, make up only a tiny portion of what's going on in the American economy. And yet, with the tariffs in place, it is a matter of time. And this is, again, what David Dorn would tell us this morning. It at some point, yes, you know, you will see the impact of these tariffs. And then, yes, you know, energy prices may go down, but there is this the other side of the story, and part of that other side is due to the tariffs. So again, my hunch would be that it's going to be difficult for Republicans, and they're not going, or they can't. How could they be happy with the Supreme Court now, and how can they be happy with the way the Democrats are going to connect the Supreme Court's decision with the economy, stupid.
In a way, we're back in a situation that we had in 2018, in 2020, in 2022, where the president, at one point former president, has become a liability to the party. He has always been a liability to the party in some sense, but he is again that his name is now tightly linked to the to the affordability crisis, to the tariff regime that gets increasingly scrutinized even by those who have followed him so far. And you've said the question is, how long will he ride this out? I've read some conservative commentary that suggested, well, this decision would now have been an easy off-ramp. We could just have taken it and gotten out of the mess that you have driven us into. But the president showed at the press conference and in the last hours that he has no intention of taking that off-ramp. What is your hunch? Because we can't have more than a hunch. Is this tariff regime something that he is ideologically committed to, or is it something that he just, because he lost now, he doesn't want to accept the defeat and therefore ride it out?
The second part, I think, is about personality. But the first one, ideology, I don't think so. In my perception, the whole complex of bringing jobs back to the United States thanks to tariffs, I think that's one of the few, well, convictions that this man has really internalized. As far as I can tell, Claudia, Donald Trump really believes in the tariff, the success of tariffs, or the potential of tariffs. And here he may be sadly, or he may be quite lonely in terms of the economist community, most of whom really disagree and fundamentally disagree with Donald Trump. But as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can tell, Trump really believes in tariffs. I think he's wrong. But your question was ideology. No, I don't think so. And that's why it's even more interesting to see how far he's going to stay, you know, how much further he's going to push this. But when you spoke, Claudia, I could not help chuckling or smiling over the fact that even with Donald Trump, who is such a disruptive force, I mean, Trump is the disruptor of our time. And yet, when I listen to you, how much courant normal, how much continuity. We have a president who is heading into the midterms and who is becoming a liability to his, you know, own party. So not everything is new. And to some extent, that is also a lot of consolation.
I think the most fascinating part of Donald Trump, I have come to find, is that there is a lot more continuity than meets the eye, but that is a bit buried because politicians like him have existed before, but on a state level in the South. And he is, in a way, a symptom or the culmination of the Southernization of American politics, in a way, and not the best part of Southernization. There's a lot of great things about Southern politics, but he's very similar to once upon a time governor of Louisiana, the Kingfish, Huey Long. And I find it quite really fascinating how there are certain recurring patterns. And the only thing where, oh, well, it's one of the many things in which he is unique is that a president who has been time and again a liability to his own party in crucial elections is still there. and how the party has not managed to get rid of him completely, or has not found the courage to get rid of him, and with that we are dragging this on and on with a lot of casualties on the American and the rest of the world side of things.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, in listening to you, I cannot help here adding that, I mean, in the office of the president of, or in the Oval Office, the style, the communication, the discourse, the very way Donald Trump acts, speaks, communicates as president is just truly unprecedented. I guess it has really shifted the imagination of how a president can actually speak, because
absolutely,
at least you know, from what I have seen, this is just it in terms of the communication, in terms of the way again he acts and speaks. This is quite something. It's quite something, to say the very least.
Yeah, but really, when we were traveling at Louisiana, I started reading about Huey Long, the governor of Once Upon a Time, and it all sounded very, very, very similar.
Similar,
extremely in a worrisome level similar, because Huey Long could only be stopped when he was shot, and that's not what we wish for. We have seen too many political assassination attempts recently, and it has the level of political violence we've seen in the last year alone has been extremely worrisome.
Oh, I agree 100%. And if I look at Switzerland at state level, what kind of characters you have seen over the past like 180 years since we turned into a federal or the Swiss Confederation 1848. If I look at characters in Swiss domestic politics, again, it is one thing, of course, to have these characters, to have their political style. If I look at Appenzell-Innerrhoden, just a few miles here from St. Gallen, quite some characters, quite some strong, very, very, very unique in their style of doing politics. And yet, if I then look at the federal government and the Swiss Federal Council, we don't have a president, of course. It's a collegium of seven individuals. And, you know, the federal level is a different thing. And that's why to have Trump speak like the governor you mentioned from Louisiana.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It is a different thing because it is the office of president of the United States.
Oh, absolutely.
And I guess that is where all the continuities also, or comes to a, where the parallel kind of comes to its limit or limitation in terms of the metaphor, because this, for heaven's sakes, is the president of the United States and thereby one of the most potent and powerful people that we have in office across the world.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree to this. He is, by constantly demeaning himself, by the way he speaks, because you're not just demeaning others, you're demeaning yourself too.
Yeah.
He's also demeaning the office and the standing of America and the world. And I think there is no way of denying that. And it will be interesting to see America hopefully heal from that. I'm an eternal optimist when it comes to America's self-correcting capabilities and dynamics. But it will be probably a lot harder a route than it was after Nixon, who has also demeaned the office. He didn't speak the way Trump did publicly. He did that privately, and people had to hear it then eventually. But that there you had a different political system in terms of lesser polarization, etc. And the system was in agreement that it needed to heal. And in 2029, there might not be this agreement, and there might not be the potential for healing that quickly. So,
absolutely.
Well,
and here we kind of come back to the point of origin today, Claudia, whereby a Supreme Court basically did its job. The founding fathers, I think, would enjoy what happened because,
well, they
again,
didn't give
you know,
the Supreme Court this exact power, but okay.
But, you know, they see one branch of government checking on the other branch of government.
Absolutely.
And that is precisely what this was all about, you know, the prevention of the abuse of power, or as Montesquieu so beautifully put it, since it is an eternal truth that power will corrupt man, il faut que par la disposition des choses, le pouvoir arrête le pouvoir. Power will ultimately check on power. And that is just a wonderful thing. And I cannot help but, again, feeling joy and relief about this, let's say, most recent twist.
I love that. And I think we should end on such a positive note, because we quite frequently in this podcast don't end on positive notes. Christoph, do you have any reading, listening, TV, whatever recommendations to our listeners who want to follow this more, who want to maybe read Montesquieu, who knows? Anything that comes to your mind that you would recommend right now?
Oh, gosh. I guess the Federalist Papers come to mind, because with Hamilton, Madison, Jay, you know, reading Federalist, which basically brings us back to the minutes of, or not the minutes, but the musings and the reflections at the time of the, you know, of building the American Constitution, how these people would ponder over how to check, how to prevent the abuse of power. So the Federalist Papers, that's just one of the things. But I had not thought about it, so I'd much rather shut up and not.
No, I think that's a wonderful
but
suggestion.
But the Federalist Papers, that's one thing. Yeah.
If angels were to govern men, well, since they
Norman
don't.
Angel. Norman Angel. Yep.
They need 9 justices to tell them to stop. I'd like to make a shameless plug to HSG Focus, because they ran a piece on Orrin Cass and American Compass. That's a think tank that is really propagating is advancing, promoting the idea that tariffs can lead to America's reindustrialization. And I think it might be interesting for people who haven't seen it yet to read on the people and the ideology behind the current tariff regime. We also had the opportunity to talk to Chris Griswold, who's policy director with American Compass, on this podcast, also quite timely to revisit. And there is one book about Supreme Court politics. Well, more specifically, the politicization of Supreme Court nominations that I really enjoyed reading and that I find very enlightening, by Ilya Shapiro, Supreme Disorder. Well, we also have a bit of Supreme Disorder, but we're ending with joy and relief. Christoph, thank you so much for making time this short notice.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for listening to us. Auf Wiedersehen.
Grüezi Amerika. Views from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.